Yes. Thanks for the ovation. It's always too good to get it at the beginning. So my name is Marek Stefani, and we're going to talk about our experience working with different groups. But I would like to start with something else at the beginning. I'm just curious if you may guess, what is this? All these like little quizzes. It's a group of people going somewhere, right? Yeah? Hmm? Yeah, it's actually not a demonstration. It's a kind of demonstration. I just came back from Tunisia 2 days ago, and a month ago, one city called Siliana had a lot of crashes and so on because the governor, the mayor of the city, didn't fulfill his obligations and so on. And at some point, the whole town decided to leave the city because he didn't want to give up his position. So everybody, frankly, everybody left the town and they said, if you want to govern, govern it for yourself, okay? I wanted you to see it because obviously it wasn't the end. It's not that the ending was happy whatsoever. The clashes continued, they didn't make it to Tunis, to the capital city, etc. I wanted to pull it up because as a reference to Jake's talk at the beginning, I was just thinking when he was talking about the surveillance state and so on, that maybe the only way we can deal with it is just switch off everything and then they can, you know, surveillance things while we're on the beach. And so on. Our experience is basically 10 years of working with different groups and different philosophies and so on. And the title of this talk is Bridging the Gap, because that's what we've been trying to do, working with the open source and free software principles, promoting free software as much as we could, and we couldn't often do that very well. Activist mindset, which is very important for us, work with people who are unhappy with things, and not necessarily they need to do revolution and rebel and leave the city. They might want to just change things within the system, and they struggle with that and so on. And our background and where we're coming from is also very creative, so we try to bring creativity, art, and kind of more visual thinking into activism and technology. Security is the principle, and the privacy that is the outcome of that is very important for our work that you're going to see in a second, and kind of hackers and coders ethics. And so we were trying to bridge these things, but now we're sick of it. And we'll tell you a little bit of a story of how we try to change it into something different than building bridges.
So earlier this year, we worked with a group of organizations who are working on collecting information on what's called land acquisition, often known by people more regularly as land grabbing. And this group of organizations have been collecting information over the past 10 years on land acquisition. In fact, they created a database of over 2,000 records of land acquisition. And we worked with them to create what's now the largest online database of land acquisition in the world. And this is quite an unlikely collaboration in some ways. And one of the things I wanted to do is put that into perspective for a minute. Looking back in the work we did from over 10 years between 1998 and 2008, when we would go to different countries, Georgia, Uganda, Egypt, these kinds of places, and we would say, we're technologists, we're information people here, and we'd like to talk to you about activism, they would usually say, great, here's the printer, can you fix it for us, please? And trying to get them to think that activism had something to do with technology was quite a difficult task. And this has really changed over the last few years. One of the things that's really changed is people's openness and interest in talking to people like us about their work. It was in the end of November 2010 when I was sitting in Cairo when a large foundation said to us, we think there might be something to do with social media and activism in Egypt. Could you look into it for us? And 4 weeks later, before we'd started the research, of course, the revolution happened, and most of the rest of the world knew that there was something to do with technology and activism, that there was a link there. So there was three things that really happened, as you know, most of these names you know very well, and probably you would think of these straight away if I asked you, that happened over the past few years that changed the way people think about activism and information and technology. And of course, those things are the uprisings in the Middle East, but also things like WikiLeaks and Anonymous, which has really changed people's perception of this relationship. So coming back to this year, working with the Land Matrix, one of the things we did was took this enormous database and visualized it so that people could start to look for patterns and trends in the data. And allow them to think, you know, from an outside view, what was in this massive amount of information. And This points to the fact that, you know, our assumptions have changed as activists, and also the methods that we're using have really changed as well, thanks to, I think, some of the developments over the past few years. And one of the things that happened is we realized that people do want to dig through data. They will have a look at masses of information and start to look for themselves. They don't need to be just given a message about how something is. They do want to look, you know, in specifically, why is the biggest private landowner in Argentina Benetton? Why does the North Face have 125,000 hectares of land there? These are the questions people want to ask. What's the relationship between a company in the United Arab Emirates that buys land the size of Denmark in Sudan? Why are they doing that? What's happening? The other thing that we realize people want to do is they will actually start to look at the data and add to it. You're going way too fast there. In working with this group who wanted to just put the database online, we said, don't worry about the fact that some of your data is unreliable. Make it open. Make it an invitation to people to come and add. Make it this something that people can download, look at themselves, and change. And that's what happened. Within just a few weeks of releasing the data, a journalist had taken it and made it into a story for a major German newspaper. Local grassroots groups in Senegal had taken the data and started working with it. And groups like Open Knowledge Foundation had taken the data, cleaned it up, and put it online for others to work with. And this proved to these organizations, who are used to more conventional ways of working, that these kind of open source philosophies might be useful to them. Thanks. So one of the things we've been trying to do is to open up this process not to as many people as possible, not just to kind of expert users. And helping people think about doing the dirty work of doing stuff like working with spreadsheets and making this less scary for activists. So one of the things we've been looking at through, we have a website called Drawing by Numbers there, helping people figure out how do you actually, what's scraping and parsing of data? What would that do for you as an activist? And you know, teaching activists to code is one step, but coming back a little bit further, just helping them understand that this is something that they can do, helping them to know what to ask for can be really, really useful. This is a screenshot from that website showing people how to use something called Open Heat Map, taking data that we work with some sex worker groups in India and Cambodia, and helping people think about how do you take a database, in this case, interviews with 22,000 sex workers, and how do you take the information from that and turn it into something meaningful that other people can do. So one of the things we're looking at here is how do you help people experiment and how do you help them get essential skills that were traditionally thought of as technical skills and to use them in activism. So this is from the website of a group called Power 254 in Kenya that we've been working with, where they actually got a truck full of paper on how it is that people are buying land in slum areas. And the question for us that we were asked was, what do we do with this truck full of paper? How do we turn it into something that people can process and look at trends in? So they have to look at difficult questions like, how do you scan all this information? How do you look for trends in it? And so on. But more importantly, they're not just sitting on evidence, but the minute they expose that evidence, they're also becoming a massive target. So looking at the question of not only what are these groups sitting on in terms of evidence, but how does, when you get evidence about who owns this slum lands, what are you doing to yourself in terms of exposure?
So just so you know, POWA stands for power, power, and 254 is a country code, Kenya, that's how we call them. So it's basically Power to Kenya is the name, and it's the collective of artists. It's the first kind of a group that is merging art with activism and technology. But when I visited them a few months ago, the problem they faced when they had this load of papers and stuff, and I started to talking to them, so what kind of security measures are you using and so on? They were like, what are you talking about? So forget, you know, PGP, forget anything else. And part of the work we do is to kind of demystify the way people talk about technology, security, privacy, and so on, because it's very tech-heavy language. And we're going to show you now a short animation we did for Tor that kind of tries to explain the concept of privacy in the context of Tor. Let's see if the sound is on. It's just a few minutes long.
Humans are creatures that like to be invisible. This is very animalistic behavior. Many animals like to be invisible in order to hide. Some do it to protect themselves. Some do it to prey on others. Humans have their own reasons to hide. Humans like to hide from other humans more than other animals like to hide from other animals. Humans have developed different tools and tactics for hiding. Some people like to be more private than others. And some situations require more privacy than others. There are also situations when privacy is forbidden and people are prevented from communicating and finding information. Recently, we met this small group of humans who love onions and privacy. They believe people should have a choice if they want to be private or not, especially if they are online. They created special services that make online communication invisible. Hidden services allow anyone to create an anonymous website, anonymous chat room, and totally anonymous email. Tor people designed hidden services so well that nobody can censor or monitor them. Not even themselves. The human need for privacy is curious. Some people need it to do innocent things. Some, however, want privacy to do problematic or dangerous things. Tor people created a tool that can be used by any human. Tor hidden services are used by all kinds of people. It is also used by activists, investigative journalists, families with members living in closed societies, military, security enforcement services, and people like you. Try it yourself.
Yeah, so the idea here... So the idea here was basically to kind of demystify the first fear that people have when you talk about Tor services, which is it's being used by pedophiles, criminals, and so on. And it is also true, but it doesn't mean that tool is wrong. The kind of other tool that there's a number of people in the room that have been working on it as well is something we've been doing for 7 years, which is called Security in a Box, which is an overview of different tools and tactics that you can use for securing your own communication in different ways. And it's focusing on overview of applications, tools, software, but also hands-on guides, and it's scenario-based. So it's not about how you use this tool to do X, Y, Z, but what you need to use when you try to do X, Y, Z. So for example, I would like to communicate with somebody that is living in an environment that is monitored, etc. I'm not gonna focus on that, you can find all the URLs later. I would like to show you another project which is also looking at the mystification of how you look at issues related to use of technology, privacy and security, which is a project that we did called Me and My Shadow. And I just show you a few screens here. It's a project where you can quickly assess your own vulnerability in terms of where you are at and what you're leaving behind as traces. And this is the first one where you can see what kind of shadow you leave behind. So you can say you have a computer, you have what kind of OS and so on, and blah, blah. And then you can see what it all means in a kind of a language that you may be able to understand in particular type of a trace, which is not going to load now because I'm offline, obviously, which is great. So you can also do other things, which is, this is like a little toolbox for how to explore your own traces, resize your traces, how to eliminate and mitigate the fact that you're leaving a lot of information and data, not only by using anything, but by just buying equipment and so on, and how you can turn around, so how you can monitor how you are being monitored, and so on. And the last thing I think there I wanted to show you is that a lot of things are hidden in a small print. So this is the example of an agreement that people sign. This is the Facebook case, which is, you know, long text, and blah, blah, etc. But when you just do a very simple thing, when you remove the language that is unnecessary and only show things that are meaningful, then you very clearly see what you're signing into. And we look at Twitter, look at Facebook, etc. So those are like very basic ways of letting people know that this is not some sort of cloud somewhere there, and we don't know what the hell is going on there. We can easily track our traces. And the next thing is, oh no, should I play it first?
No.
No.
There's me and my shadow and security in the boxes, and the video you just saw, the tour video, is looking at this kind of more technical aspects. But we think that we shouldn't let this, our sophistication with technology, blind us to the fact that many of the traps that people fall into are really simple ones. That much of our job is, we find, is translating these concepts to people who are users who aren't really looking into the details of how these things work. And sometimes the weakest point, actually, and often the weakest point, is the human one. So technically, you may be able to fix something, but it's how people are using technology that creates problems. So we're just going to show you a clip from one of our characters that we've been using, which is a little robot called Ono, that helps explain these concepts to people. So this a little clip from Honor, and there are many more of those online. But when I play that sometimes, I mean, I've played it before to an audience of kind of more security technology people, actually some of whom I see in the room here. And they say, but looking at this password level, this is like not going to keep anybody safe. And then I would like to remind them of this story. If you just, which is, you may know this, earlier this year that opposition hacker Abdullah Al-Shami, looking at the private email address of Assad, which is sam@al-shaba, they spent a week, these hackers, trying to figure out what his password was and coming up with all kinds of combinations and ways of doing this, when they said, hang on a minute, what would be the most stupid thing for it to be? You know, password 1234 was what it was. And through that, they actually managed to release 3,000 emails directly to The Guardian, private emails from Assad, and then they used this and monitored it. They didn't get really crucial information they were expecting, but they were able to warn some of the opposition leaders that they knew were under pressure from what they found in the emails. It's kind of... sorry.
No, not yet.
My driver is out of control. now I find it hard to go back. So going back to Syria for a second. Looking at this question, you know, it's quite funny, and it's great for us when Assad sets his password to 1234. But unfortunately, for some of the Syrian activists that we work with, if they, when they come in, we've done trainings with them, or they come into our offices, it's really not amusing when we're finding out that one of the ways in which massive networks of activists are exposed is because when somebody's arrested with their laptop, they have their Skype history open, or they have a Facebook account open, and thousands, of, well, networks of hundreds of people are exposed through these very, very simple things. Which reminds us, I think, that, as we like to say, the devil's in the default, and there's very, very small things that, that normal users can do to actually protect themselves, which are not being done. Thank you, Marek.
Okay.
So just coming back to this first question, about bridging the gap. The reason why we said bridge the gap or destroy it was for this kind of reason, that we want to break the idea that technologists are there to fix the printer, we think. And on the other hand, we want to break the idea that activists are just stupid users. And we want to help them learn from each other. Both these groups of people know how things work, one very much in the world of information and the other very much in the world of politics. And when you put them together, you can create, you know, very beautiful things. When they can learn from each other about the skills that they, the different skills they have and the different techniques and approaches they have and mix them in the right way, we're finding that you create a new kind of activism that can be much more effective.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that not everybody can be Jake, of course, that is an activist, you know, as a creative person, strongly believes in open source, is a good coder, and so on. But you can still teach journalists to crack some code and so on, and it's extremely important nowadays. So what else we should say?
Nothing, just to, nothing, if you have except for the fact that we have a, there are a number of people that we work with in the room here, I think, who would agree with us, and including we have some colleagues here, so just wanted to say hello to them out there, that we're not here alone. There's at least Anna over there sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. She actually is taking care of me and my shadow, you would like to talk to her. Yeah. But if you have any questions, it's okay if you don't have any.
If you have questions,
go ahead. I think it's good time.
Just a minute. Let me coordinate the questions. We have two microphones over here, so if anyone has any questions, please queue up. And let's give a first round of applause. just one thing, if you're leaving during the question session, please be quiet. We have 15 minutes until the next talk comes on. I'm going to have to ask you to please leave through this door. The door up here is for entrance. This is for exit, because we're running really tight. So the first question is from over to the right.
So you said that you're talking to the Syrian activists on how they should take some basic measures to avoid getting their information taken, like not leaving the accounts logged in, etc., etc. But do you get into... So everybody probably knows what's the rubber hose method for for breaking encryption. You get the rubber hose and beat the key out of the person, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything, because, like, do you give any such explanations and methods for these people to how to handle this kind of problem?
Yeah.
How do they handle the rubber hose method? How do they deniable encryption, stuff like this?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, one of the problems we've had in working with digital security experts and training activists is that technically it's possible to lock down things. You know, technically it's possible to make a laptop completely impenetrable. But if that just moves the threat to the physical, is that really a good idea? And so we're trying to teach people strategies for, you know, mixed strategies for example, having a laptop that's open and having most of the information there, but hiding some specific things, for example, in something that looks like an image. So finding these very basic techniques that just help people think about security from actually quite a common sense point of view, not necessarily just a technical point of view, and bringing these things together.
I would add to that, I mean, this is actually a very important question, because when you talk about digital security and so on, you forget about the fact that the physical security is in the first place. And through the, you know, through the beating, you can basically force people to do a lot of things. And not only that, but also we focused recently on the kind of a psychological effects or bad effects of being in distressed situations where neither digital or physical methods anymore, but you have to live with certain things for longer and so on. So we try to merge these three elements, the physical, the psychological, and technical together when we work with activists and so on, as I'm trying to say.
Thank you.
Next questions come from the left.
Hi. How do you deal with long-term awareness problems. Like, in my job, I noticed that you can tell people, you know, use 18 character passwords, lowercase, uppercase, and they do it once, and then 2 months later, they'll go, well, I need a new password because they told me to change my password, so it's going to be password one, and then it's going to be password two, and then it goes 1, 2, 3, 4. How do you deal with long-term and awareness on a topic?
Well, there's a few aspects to that, because long-term is a big problem, but it's also a problem with activists that often they say that security and privacy, even these kind of things, are not important to them because they get, you know, death threats every day anyway, so why they would bother remembering, you know, seven, you know, whatever letter passwords and so on. But then you move on into the argument that it's not just about their own privacy and safety, it's also about something that they strongly believe in, which is responsibility for the community, for others. And so when you talk to people that, you know, not just about exposing yourself, but about exposing others and so on, it's a completely different discussion, and then you think twice about how you deal with these things. But obviously human nature is human nature, so yeah, if you don't repeat things, they...
It does have a bit of the problem of the kind of... It's like the climate change syndrome. Telling everybody the world's going to end isn't going to stop people from doing stupid things, and telling people that they're at risk isn't necessarily going to help them. It's usually only, unfortunately, when they have themselves experienced or somebody they know has experienced something really horrific that they change their habits. And so, yeah, finding other ways to try and motivate them is about the only way. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question from the right.
So I had seen the video about hidden services before, and... one of my thoughts is that, okay, they're making a strong statement about like how unbreakable it is. Even the Tor also said it's, you know, there is way to attack hidden services. And also in the way security in a box, I really like the way it focuses on use cases. But it still says security in a box. And I don't think you can put security in a box. Security is a process, and it's about habits, and it's about this kind of thing. And how do you... tackle this problem on explaining to people that actually, you know, preventing the false sense of security than often you can get because you have the right tool, because it says secure and it actually, you know.
Well, you know, our kind of philosophy is that security is an aspiration, it's not a set thing. So you can aspire to be secure, but the assumption is you never will be. And it's kind of related to circumstances and situations. So some things may help you at a given point to do something that's important to do, but you know, 5 minutes later they may not anymore, etc. So through training and so on, if you write the descriptions that we put, it is about you know also raising awareness that this is not ideal toolkit that we always protect you and so on. And also the reason is reduced. You don't find all the newest and possible tools there because they are peer-reviewed, and we look at those that actually are proven that work. The code is open, etc., and we work with a lot of people to try to make it even better, knowing that it never will be perfect. And there's a certain risk when you are an activist and so on that you have to take on your own. And what we're trying to do is also raise that it is important to take this risk with some consciousness of what the consequences may be. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's no good answer to that question. You know that very well, asking it. So, thanks for asking, though.
Thanks. I think the last question would be over here.
Okay, so I have
just we. Huh? Oh, say you first, and then Signal Angels.
Oh, okay. There's something from there. But...
So I have a question. Working with activist groups, how much like percentage is actually connected with? Technical problems, and what is the part of the physical security? Basically, what I face working with an activist group is like most of the things they do is fucked up with physical security rather than technical security.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems is that they're not connected for people. So, for example, when we work with human rights defenders and journalists, there are actually organizations who go out and train physical security, but they never talk about digital security. So they may talk about how do you pass through a border, but they would never give you any advice on what you're carrying on you because they don't know anything about it. So I think they're very much linked is the answer, and we're trying to do work actually this next year, which will be putting these things together. And right now, if you're a human rights defender or a journalist, it's very confusing when you get two completely different trainings, two completely different sets of advice. And increasingly, these things have to be merged because, as you're pointing out, the correlation between them is, you know, is very strong. Yeah.
Signal Angels.
Yeah, there's a question from RSC. Are you supporting or developing any persistent life distribution aimed at security or privacy, like Dan and Bollock entails?
We don't develop anything. That's the answer. Like we work with developers and we promote certain things, but we don't develop except this kind of toolkits that help you understand things. We don't develop any live distros and so on. But we work with Tails, and at the last meeting, some people were putting together a live CD based on Tails that would allow people to work with much more complex data. People who work with a lot of video documentation of human rights abuses, where they need something much more robust, and that would enable them to upload a lot of complex videos and so on, etc. But we don't develop anything.
Thank you. Let's give a round of applause.